Ryan Jennings has the news in full.
The new limits on mortgage lending announced by the central bank are set to apply within a matter of days. Those planning to buy homes will now have to save bigger deposits under the new regulations. However, restrictions on first-time buyers will not be as great. The Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, said these revised proposals would provide certainty to borrowers and ensure that banks continued to engage in prudent lending practices. Mary Calpin reports.
The new borrowing rules will come into force as soon as the legislation passes the Oireachtas, which may happen over the coming days. Under the plan, non-first-time borrowers will have to come up with bigger deposits, as banks will only be able to lend up to a maximum of 80% of a property's value, and the loan will be limited to 3.5 times earnings. But there will be some relief for first-time buyers, who will be able to borrow up to 90% to a limit of €220,000. Any loan over this amount will require a 20% deposit for that portion of the mortgage. A 70% limit will apply for banks lending to investors purchasing buy-to-let properties. The Sinn Féin spokesman on finance, Piers Doherty, gave a broad welcome to the central bank's announcement and said the rules should help to establish a normal, healthy lending market. Fianna Fáil spokesman on finance, Michael McGrath, welcomed the easing of restrictions for first-time buyers, but said it would prove impossible for many non-first-time buyers to meet the 20% deposit requirement if they wanted to move out of homes that no longer suited their needs.
The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has condemned the release of a new video showing a Japanese hostage being held by the Islamic State group. In the film, the IS militant say the journalist Kenji Goto and another hostage, a Jordanian fighter pilot, will be killed today unless Jordan released a suicide bomber held on death row. Mr. Abe called on Jordan to cooperate in working for Mr. Goto's quick release, but he said that his government would not give in to terrorism.
This was an extremely despicable act and we feel strong indignation. We strongly condemn that. While this is a tough situation, our policy remains unchanged in seeking cooperation from the Jordanian government for the release of Mr. Goto.
Apple Computers is reported to have made the biggest quarterly profit by a public company in corporate history, largely due to the success of the new iPhone 6. The company recorded a net profit of $18 billion from sales in October, November and December last year. Apple sold 74.5 million iPhones during this period, with sales in China doubling. Daniel Aaron Dilger of the Apple Insider website said one of the keys to Apple's success was its array of products.
Apple basically sells computers. They would like you to buy a $2,000 Macintosh, but if there's a whole generation of young people that are buying phones instead of computers. And so they're selling iPhones, and if you're not going to buy an iPhone, they'll sell you an iPad, and they'll still sell you an iPod. Whether or not they're selling you one or the other doesn't really matter. And when you buy the high-end iPhone 6 Plus, for example, you're generating as much revenue and more profit for Apple than if you would have bought an entry-level phone, an entry-level iPad, and a little iPod Shuffle.
The head of the World Bank, Jim Yong Kim, has warned that the Ebola epidemic in West Africa has shown that the world is dangerously unprepared for potentially catastrophic pandemics. He has urged governments, corporations, aid agencies and insurance companies to work together to build a system to prepare for future outbreaks.
If we'd had all these conversations prior to December 2013, the cost of the Ebola outbreak would have been minimal. We would have been able to put it out immediately. We would have had teams ready to go. We would have had private sector companies, vaccine manufacturers, everybody lined up to respond. We would have put it out.
Gardaí investigating a fire at the constituency office of the Fine Gael TD Michelle Mulhern in Ballina in County Mayo have questioned a man. It's understood flammable material was thrown through a window on the ground floor of the terraced property shortly after 7 o'clock yesterday evening. The office was unoccupied at the time and the fire was put out soon afterwards. A 39-year-old man was arrested in Ballina late last night. He was released without charge in the early hours of this morning. Gardaí say their investigation is continuing and a technical examination will be carried out at the building later today. The Kremlin has said that the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, has accepted an invitation to attend a ceremony in Moscow to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. If the North Korean leader does go, it would be the first time for him to leave his own country since taking power 3 years ago. Now the time is coming up to 6:30 past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant Engineering. The Grant Vortex Condensing Oil Boiler, providing super efficient, reliable and lower cost heating. Think boilers, think Grant.
It'll be very cold and windy today. Scattered rain showers will turn to sleet and snow later. Highest temperatures will range between 2 and 5 degrees in a strong to gale force wind. And there's a warning that west to northwest winds will reach gale or strong gale force today in all sea areas and in the Irish Sea.
RTE.
Fiona Kelly is back with it, says in the papers.
The reprieve given to first-time buyers in the revised mortgage plan announced by the Central Bank yesterday provides a lead story in both the Irish Times and Irish Independent this morning. Although the Independent suggests that the new system will discriminate against those living in cities and large towns where house prices are higher. The Irish Daily Mail also leads with this story today, taking the line that the new rules have slammed the door on those who want to trade up. Anti-Austerity Alliance Deputy Paul Murphy has defended the right of water protesters to target the president because he signed the water charges bill into law. This follows the release of a video on YouTube which shows protesters in Finglas running after Michael D. Higgins' car and shouting verbal abuse at him last Friday. That's the lead story in today's Irish Examiner. The Times and Independent, meanwhile, report on the President's address to the Council of Europe yesterday, in which he said that Ireland should not be used as some kind of exemplar. The Irish economy is not a driverless car, he said. It has citizens aboard who paid a very high price. President Higgins makes a timely call, is the headline over the lead editorial in today's Independent. The Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun lead today with the Elaine O'Hara murder trial. The Irish Daily Mirror leads with the petrol bomb attack last night on the office of Fine Gael TD Michelle Mulhern in Ballina. And that story is also carried on the front of today's Independent and Examiner. For its lead story today, the Herald reports that Irish international and Derby County player Jeff Hendrick was released without charge after being questioned by Gardaí last week about an assault outside a Dublin nightclub. Back in the front of the Examiner, there's a story there about how the parents of a four-year-old cancer patient in the Midlands who was turned down for a medical card are being pursued by a hospital debt collector for a bill of almost €1,000. The Times, meanwhile, runs with the front page story about the IMF's warning yesterday that there's limited room in the budget for a hike in public sector wages. The picture in the front of today's Times, meanwhile, is of an Auschwitz survivor walking through the gates of the concentration camp after yesterday's ceremony to mark the 70-year anniversary of its liberation. Taoiseach the Joan Burton is facing a Labour Party backbench revolt unless she blocks the sale of Aer Lingus to IAG. That's in the front of the Independent. While inside today's paper, David McWilliam's line is that Aer Lingus needs to think about global trends, not local concerns. And the headline over Matt Cooper's piece in today's Mail, meanwhile, reads, "Let's follow our heads, not the harp, when it comes to sale of Aer Lingus share." Elsewhere this morning, VHI premiums are to come down by 3% for some customers and are to remain static for everyone else. That story is carried in a number of this morning's papers, as is a report on Sharon Shannon and her manager John Dunford, who consented to a €520,000 judgment against them in the High Court yesterday after they allegedly failed to make repayments on a business loan. Most of today's papers also report that a ruling on the outcome of the examinership of Fawcett Circus is expected early next month. The Examiner has a story about how a village shop in Ardfert, County Kerry, was raided for the third time in 2 months last Thursday. The old-style shuppa has been run by 73-year-old Jimmy Collins since 1958. The Examiner also has another story today about how the Dublin Simon Community and Dogs Trust have launched a six-month pilot scheme which will allow homeless people to stay in sheltered accommodation with their pets. We're told that homeless dog owners regularly refuse offers of shelter because their dog, who is often their best friend and companion, isn't allowed to stay with them. But finally, a number of today's papers run with picture stories about the three-legged calf born on a farm outside Skibbereen, County Cork last week. Farmer David Cregan tells today's Mail that he's been inundated with calls from well-wishers since the birth and that although he did have to prop him up for the first few days to drink, the new arrival is now well able to stand up and hop about himself. He's also been given the name of Cassidy after the famous fictional cowboy Hopalong Cassidy.
Oh, fair play to him, Fiona. And we're returning next to the new mortgage lending rules, which, depending on your point of view, are either eminently sensible or highly unfair. The governor of the central bank, Patrick Honohan, says the limits will help to ensure a stable and well-functioning market. Under the scheme announced last night and likely to become law shortly, borrowers will have to come up with bigger deposits. Banks will be able to lend up to a maximum of 80% of a property's value. There will, though, be some relief for first-time buyers. They'll be able to borrow up to 90% to a limit of €220,000. Our economics correspondent, Sean Whelan, has been asking Patrick Honohan about the changes.
Well, the most of the original proposal is in place. The basic 80% loan to value is still in place. But we have made an important, I think for many people, an important exception for first-time buyers of lower-cost houses. So we're going to allow the banks, if they want, or if they're ready to do so, to lend up to 90% of the price of a house up to 220,000, and then a sliding scale up from then.
Governor, why did you change the proposal for first-time buyers?
We went out for the consultation with a strong set of proposals. We knew we had a certain margin of manoeuvre. We wanted to have a sense of what the general public and commentators would like to see, if there was a margin of manoeuvre, where to move. And we felt it's quite safe to move in the direction of helping the low-price first-time buyers. First-time buyers of the smaller houses never caused a boom. And it's stopping a boom and preventing that credit-chasing, prices-chasing credit kind of bubble that we're trying to ensure.
Why did you come up with this figure of 220,000, though, for the cut-off point?
You know, in Dublin, and it's Dublin that counts here because the rest of the country is not showing any evidence of any kind of very rapid price increase. In Dublin, about half of the houses that are being bought by first-time buyers these days with credit are below that price, 220,000. So that gives you a rough feeling for why we aimed in that direction.
And when you say there's a sliding scale above 220,000, how does that work?
Well, it works for the part of the price of the house above 220,000, it's 20% on the extra. So by the time you get to, 440,000, well, it's going to be an 85% average on the whole lot.
Right. What about buy-to-let properties? Where do they fit into
this? No change on the buy-to-lets. Buy-to-let, that does have the tendency to contribute a lot to bubble-like atmosphere, and we're strictly limiting those to the 70% loan to value, although allowing, as we do for all of these, a margin for the banks, a leeway in case they find cases that they can safely lend above. It's a small leeway for the buy-to-lets, just 10% of their portfolio in that area, but for the others there's a 15% leeway. So special cases, people may say, well, I'm not a first-time buyer, but I have this particular situation that really makes it sense for me to have higher, and if the banks agree, but it is the bank's decision. We're not second-guessing the bank's decision, and if the banks weren't going to give that person a loan, they're not going to give it now. What we're imposing is a cap on what banks do.
As you know, there's a lot of people still in negative equity on their housing mortgages. Quite a lot of them would like to trade up. How are they going to be affected by this? Are they going to now have to come up with a 20% deposit as well as dealing with their negative equity situation?
Not from our rules point of view. We looked at this very closely and came up with all sorts of complicated ideas about how to deal with negative equity. And then we looked at the facts more closely and we realized that in fact, people in negative equity, there are very few of them. And so since we're looking at the system as a whole, we're looking at avoiding a bubble, avoiding a big boom again, we decided there's no point in making any special regulation for negative equity. They'll just be dealing with their bank as if there was no regulation.
And when do these...
Of this type, of course, the regulation on banks.
And when do these new rules come into effect?
They come into effect, pretty soon. We're finalising the regulations. They're then laid before the Oireachtas. As soon as they're laid before the Oireachtas, they come into effect. So it's a matter of days.
Days, not even weeks?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. But why did you introduce this measure? Was it to control prices or was it to make the banks safer?
We're not targeting any price level. We're not going out there and saying prices are right now or there should be this level lower or this level higher. What we're trying to prevent is that psychological loop between credit and prices and credit. If we can avoid that, we can keep banks safe, we can keep borrowers safe. It's important that borrowers don't get over-indebted because of another housing bubble.
What about the impact that this will have on other areas? I mean, construction industry, we all know there's a great shortage of housing at the moment, great demand for housing, but there's been some evidence that people have been holding off committing to constructing because they just weren't sure about the proposals that were coming from the central bank. I mean, how do you think it's going to impact now on the construction sector?
Well, I'm sure this will give clarity. There may have been a certain amount of uncertainty that there had to be as long as we had a consultation. I think it was good to have a consultation. I think there are a lot of things that need to be done, and everybody agrees with this, in the housing market. What we're doing is preventing one dimension of risk. And among the several background papers and discussions that we're will be releasing over the next day or two are papers which go through what we discovered from the consultation and from thinking about the broader issues, things that we can't in the central bank do an awful lot about, but other players can. They're not new things, but we're laying them out. We do understand that this is a wider context, but we need to act on our area. There also needs to be action, I think, no dispute, to improve the housing supply in Dublin.
The government made clear their views as part of the consultation. They were concerned about equity issues, that people wouldn't be able to get on the property ladder. Do you get the sense that they're okay with these new set of proposals?
I have consulted with the Minister for Finance, as I'm obliged to do, and I understand that he's happy with the way, whether he's happy or not, he's okay with it. But in fact, we listened to the consultation from all sides. Lots of people that consulted, and you'll see all the consultations and our discussion of the consultations, a lot of the people who responded to our consultation were actually saying, make sure you don't ease these up too much to allow a bubble to get going again. So I know there were a lot of people who were concerned about first-time buyers. We dealt with that without causing a risk.
Is a bubble starting up now, or is this a precautionary measure?
It is a precautionary measure. I think we've had a big bounce back in Dublin. It's been a very spectacular, if you like, bounce back when you measure it at 40% growth in prices in 18 months. That's very, very fast. If it's a bounce back, that's fine, but a bounce back could get out of hand, and that's why we needed to act now before that psychology of panic and got to get into the market before it goes up too high took hold.
Well, the definitions of a central banker, I'm sure you know it, is the one about taking away the punch bowl just as the party is getting started.
And you know what?
Have you made off with the punch bowl, Governor?
And you know what? People complain when you do that.
They do complain. You're happy enough to put up with those complaints?
I think we've got the balance right. I'm very comfortable with what we've the modifications we've made, which I think are closer to exactly what the economy wants. So you will see that we've been doing quite a lot of research, even over the last 3 months, to confirm that we are going the right way in the direction of relieving first-time buyer situation.
And that was Patrick Honohan, the Governor of the Central Bank. He was speaking last night to our economics correspondent, Sean Whelan. It's 22 minutes.
Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, is here. Good morning, Minister.
Morning.
We'll talk health in a moment, but first you were listening to Patrick Honohan there. What do you think? How will these new rules help stop another property bubble?
Well, I think I suppose to understand this, you have to back up a little and recall that 7 years ago our economy crashed, and at the root of that crash was a housing and construction bubble, which was very much fueled by credit, reckless borrowing and reckless lending. And it's really only now, because of the enormous sacrifices that people have made, that our economy is now recovering. You know, there's 80,000 people back at work. House prices are rising again. There's more money in people's payslips this month. But the recovery isn't secure yet. It is fragile, and there are threats to that recovery. And among those threats are things like political instability here or abroad, but also the potential return of a credit bubble or a property bubble. And the measures that the central bank have put in place are designed to avoid that.
Do you think they'll work?
I think they will. I don't think they'll work on their own. Obviously, one of the things that is necessary to make sure we don't have house prices spiking again in the cities in particular is an increase in supply. We do need to start building many more houses again. But I do think this makes sense. And if you go back 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, it wasn't unusual for people to have to have a substantial deposit before they bought a house, and banks were restricted in how much they could lend in terms of the multiple of your income. So I think this is sensible. It's prudential. It's not just about protecting the banks, it's also about protecting the public from another credit-fueled property bubble, which is in nobody's interest.
In May, the Taoiseach said he was very sorry that thousands of sick people had their medical cards removed. This was after your party lost several seats at the local elections, and he promised to fix the system. Now, you promised to make it more sensitive, you said in November, but still award cards based on financial means and not illness. You're appointing a clinical advisory group today. What will they do that the expert panel that was there before them didn't or couldn't do?
Yeah, well, I should say this is all still very much a work in progress, and I do very much welcome the feedback from the various different advocacy groups, whether it's Age Action or Jack and Jill or other groups like that. What's happened so far is that where a medical card is awarded on the basis of a terminal illness, it's no longer reviewed. We don't do routine reviews of discretionary medical cards, and there is now broader and wider discretion. Even when somebody is over the income limit, if they have significant medical expenses, they can qualify for a medical card. And the proof of that is in the numbers. The number of discretionary medical cards in circulation has gone up from about 50,000 this time last year to 75,000 now. And when you include discretionary doctor visit cards, there's 108,000 now, which is higher than there was when this government came to office. So, you know, the situation is improving. It is far from perfect yet. And the next step in those reforms is the appointment this week of the clinical advisory group. And what they're going to do, which the expert group didn't do, is draw up a set of guidelines around which officials and medical officers who are processing medical card applications can disregard the means test, if you like, yeah, and say that because of because the burden of illness is so great on an individual or a family, they can still get a medical card even when their income is above the means test.
A work in progress. Why is this all taking so long, by the way? I mean, your government were told about these problems last January. The Taoiseach finally admitted there was a problem in May, and you said in November that this advisory group was being established. It takes another 3 months to appoint it, another 3 months to report. Are you kicking to touch here?
No, definitely not. And if we were, we wouldn't have had that 50% increase in the number of discretionary cards
that
are out
there. This group is going to sit for 2 years. Why?
Well, that's not quite the case. What they will do is they'll be established this week, and quite frankly, it's been difficult to get people to agree.
Why?
To sit on it, because it's a very complicated area trying to come up with a set of guidelines to assess how unwell and what burden of illness somebody is suffering from. But what's going to happen is they'll have 3 months to draw up the revised guidelines for discretionary cards, but they will stay in place for 2 years, because we're never going to assume that we get this exactly right, and medicine changes and circumstances change, and what we want to have them there is to keep reviewing the guidelines on you know, as things develop. But also if there's a doubt, if there's a very difficult case, the official in the HSC or the medical officer can then go to that group for advice. So that's why they're there for.
You mentioned
this to be a standing
cases.
Committee essentially.
I don't want to highlight individual cases, but there are lots of them, and you'll be aware of some of them. Very ill children with very worried parents, in all their cases being made, as they would see it, to jump through hoops to get to a medical card, while you and your government want to persist with giving free GP care eventually to all children, healthy, wealthy or otherwise, just because they're under six. How is that fair?
Well, obviously I can't comment on individual cases. You know, I don't have any application forms on my desk,
yes,
and I don't
I
have access to families' financial
but
information.
But the principle of sick children being made to jump through hoops to get cards, with healthy children under the age of six being awarded them on the basis of age.
Yeah, the situation is as this, and I've looked at this in so many different ways, so many different times, is that until we have universal healthcare in Ireland, until everyone is entitled to healthcare, regardless of their income, there are always going to be people who are just above a threshold, whether it's an income threshold or a threshold based on medical hardship. So what we need to do is phase in, over time, a system of universal healthcare. The first step to that is access to a GP without fees for everyone over 70 and everyone under 6. It's not just happening on its own. It's part of a number of things that are happening, and this is the first phase. And bear in mind, particularly when it comes to the under 6s, it's not just extending the doctor visit card to, we'll say, the children of middle class and better off parents. It's a whole new primary care service for all children under 6, which will include things like public health
surveillance.
But if
you have a sick child over the age of 6, can you understand why the system seems deeply unfair.
Yeah, of course I can, and that's why we've widened discretion already, and that's why we're appointing the clinical advisory group to widen it further to take into account medical hardship and the burden of an illness on an individual or their family, regardless of their income.
A new pay structure for new hospital consultants you're also announcing. This is off the back, of course, of the ballot where the IMO have agreed to this. Why will this attract more doctors to apply to fill vacant posts, in your view? Because they're going to be paid more?
Yeah, in part. First of all, when we talk about health, it does tend to focus on the things that are going wrong or the various controversies, and there are a lot of them, but there are some good things happening in health. Yesterday, we had two items of good news. The first was that VHI was freezing its premiums and reducing some premiums, and that follows on from the fact that Leia made a decision as well earlier on to reduce some of its premiums and freeze others. And that's important because one of our objectives is to make health insurance more affordable for people and to increase the number of people who have insurance cover. Again, that's part of the move towards universal insurance. The other good news yesterday was
that you're going to pay new hospital consultants more money. Is that what's required to attract more of them to apply for jobs? Yes,
it is. The reality is that roughly speaking, there are 250 vacant consultant posts around the country, and as a result of that, in hospitals there aren't enough senior decision makers, so patients aren't getting the standard of care that they should be getting, and in some cases are being admitted unnecessarily, and also in some cases we can't get waiting lists down because there are no consultants to see the patients. So this does mean the partial restoration of pay for consultants. It's nothing like what they were paid 5 or 6 years ago,
nothing like what many of them can earn when they're doing private work. If you're going to pay them more to do public work, will you make sure that those who are hired to do the job do what they're paid to do? If they're hired to do 37 or 39 hours public service a month, how are you going to make sure they do that?
Yeah, there are different pay scales depending on whether you're a consultant who works only in the public sector or whether you're allowed to do private work as well. And essentially what's in place are medical manpower managers. And this is why you do need managers in the health service, by the way, to make sure that consultants honour the terms and conditions
and
of their
contract.
Well, if they don't, then that's a breach of contract and requires disciplinary action.
Have you had to do that yet?
I haven't personally come across it, but it is the role, obviously, both of clinical directors, who are senior doctors within the hospital, and the medical manpower managers to make sure that consultants honour their contracts. But what I do know for a fact is that the vast majority of consultants, maybe 70-80%, not only do the hours they're paid to do, but actually do extra hours. And I think it's important to point out that any consultants who are not honouring the terms of their contracts are very much in the minority.
I'll get to Brian Jennings with news headlines in a moment. If you're watching on RT News now, you'll see that he has come into our studio. Just two other matters I wanted to get to, Minister, before we go. As former Transport Minister, do you believe it's in the country's best interests to sell Aer Lingus?
Well, look, we're in an offer period at the moment, so I'm limited in what I can say. The government's position is that any offer, of course, has to be considered. It's not just about money, it's not just about the value of the 25% stake. We're also going to take into account other things, as we did in the past during previous offers when I was minister, issues like competition, issues like connectivity, which is so important for all of our airports.
If they're that important, should we keep our stake?
Well, that's something obviously the government has to.
What do you think?
I'm not at liberty to have that conversation here, unfortunately. That's something that I can only have around the cabinet table.
Front page of the Irish Examiner this morning, TD defends Higgins abusers. This is Michael D. Higgins, the president, who, according to the Examiner, was being verbally abused by demonstrators in Dublin yesterday. Anti-Austerity Alliance Deputy Paul Murphy insisted the president was a legitimate focus for campaigners to demonstrate against, as he had signed the water charge bill into law without referring it for review. What do you think?
Well, I suppose what strikes me is that as the water protesters get fewer, they're getting nastier. And what we have here is something that I've never seen before. Under our constitution, the president is above day-to-day politics. If a bill is constitutional, he has to sign it. It's not his choice as to whether he signs it or not. And to see him targeted in this way, I think, is an attack on our constitution. And even the kind of language used against him really is beneath common decency.
Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, thank you for coming in this morning. 8:33.
Now, and Pádraig Lodge joins us with sports news. Good morning to you, Pádraig.
Hi, Rachel. Good morning. Well, Chelsea are through to the final of the English League Cup. The Blues beat Liverpool 1-0 after extra time in their semi-final at Stamford Bridge, giving them a 2-1 win in aggregate. Branislav Ivanovic headed in the winner 4 minutes into extra time. It was a heated contest with 9 bookings and a confrontation between the managers on the touchline. Diego Costa was twice accused of stamping during the game but escaped without punishment. He also had strong claims for a penalty early in the first half. This was the assessment of the Liverpool manager Brendan Rodgers.
I think over the two legs we were the better side, but their goalkeeper has got them to the final. I think up at Anfield and here tonight he's made some very, very important saves, and as I said, that has won them the game. Obviously they got the goal just at the beginning of extra time, but it was irrelevant. We needed to score tonight, really. So, but I think the players gave everything. You know, they were dead in the feet at the end. They pressed, they worked. Some of the football was fantastic. And we created chances to win the game. But unfortunately, just weren't quite clinical enough.
Tottenham will carry a 1-0 lead over Sheffield United into tonight's second leg of the second semi-final at Bramall Lane, and the final will take place in Wembley on the 1st of March. The Dublin club Cabinteely FC is poised to become the 8th club in the League of Ireland First Division for the coming season. Cabinteely chairman Mark Smith confirmed in a statement that the club had agreed in principle with Blackrock Rugby Club to play their home matches in Stradbrook and to also use the rugby ground for training. Confirmation of the lineup for the First Division is still awaited from the FAI. American teenager Madison Keys has qualified for her first Grand Slam semi-final with a 3-set victory over Venus Williams at the Australian Open in Melbourne. The 19-year-old will now face the top seed Serena Williams in Friday's semi-final. Williams swept past Dominika Cibulkova 6-2, 6-2. The defending men's singles champion Stan Wawrinka overcame Kei Nishikori in straight sets, and he's now through to the semi-finals where he'll meet either Novak Djokovic or Milos Raonic. Their match is just starting around now. Two retirements to report from inter-county hurling this morning. Wexford's Keith Rossiter is bowing out at the age of 31. He made the announcement to his teammates at training last night, and Offaly's James Rigney has also brought an end to his inter-county involvement. Six players who featured in Tyrone's Dr. McKenna Cup panel are no longer involved. Joe McMahon, Dermot Carlin and Kyle Coney have left the panel, while Mark Donnelly, Plunkett Kane and Kevin Gallagher have been dropped. In his annual report, the GAA Director General Pádraig Duffy has said the broadcasting of games on Sky Sports has led to a huge increase in interest in Gaelic games among English people who have been, he says they've been arriving in substantial numbers at clubs in Britain seeking to take up football and hurling.
Really?
Yes. Now, we didn't give any figures, but substantial numbers.
That's what they saw on the telly?
Yes, the exposure of championship games and high-profile championship games is...
Hope they've brought a helmet.
Definitely needed anyway. But it's not just the men who are going to get their first taste of league action this weekend, because the Tesco Homegrown Ladies National League begins on Sunday with the finals taking place in Parnell Park in May. Dublin will begin with a home game against Monaghan, while Cork will travel to Mayo. Now, as well as claiming league and championship honours last year, Cork won the RTE Sport Team of the Year award. Eamon Ryan will again be in charge, and Dieran O'Sullivan will be one of their key players.
We find the league really important and a building stone for the championship. Last year's in the league, it was Dublin and ourselves in the league final, and Dublin and ourselves in the championship final. So it does bear a big part in the championship. You kind of get up to full steam for championship matches during the league.
And I was going to say that, is it really that important? Is it to blood new players, etc.?
Yeah, we find it really important. I suppose we've 6 or 7 girls trialling this year now for their first time, and they're looking to get a place on the squad, and there's no better place to do it than the league. There's not too much pressure on girls to perform. It's not like knockout, it's not the end of the world, you know, so it is important. We find it anyway, but different teams play it. Some teams only try stuff and here and there different things, but we find the league fierce important, chat.
That's Dieran O'Sullivan with Eamon Horan. The title holders UCC began the defence of their Sigerson Cup with a 3-15-1-6 win over Cork IT. Fullback Niamh Briggs is the new captain of the Ireland women's rugby team. The Waterford woman has 45 caps and replaces the retired Grand Slam winning captain Fiona Coughlin. Meanwhile, Sean O'Brien looks set to make an international appearance for the first time in 14 months this Friday, with indications that he'll feature for the Ireland Wolfhounds against England Saxons at Musgrave Park. At the World Cup Sailing Regatta in Miami, Annalise Murphy placed 5th and 3rd in her races, and she's now 2nd in the overall standings. While in racing, Sunday's Boyle Sports Tide Cottage Chase at Punchestown has attracted an initial entry of 11 runners, including the Cheltenham runner-up Hidden Cyclone.
Thank you very much, Pádraig. A voluntary organisation which gives workshops to secondary school pupils on how to tackle homophobic bullying found itself at the centre of an unexpected controversy yesterday when its planned visit to a Dublin school was called off at the last minute. The organisation known as Shout Out says its volunteers were disappointed and surprised that the workshop at Cailleadh the Óin in Stillorgan didn't go ahead. I've been talking to Declan Meehan, who's the co-founder of Shout Out, and he started by telling me about their work.
Shout Out is a national voluntary organisation which has about 150 volunteers nationwide, and we basically deliver an anti-bullying workshop in secondary schools for transition years and above that aims to tackle homophobia and transphobia.
Now, you've been to Cailleadh the Óin before.
We have, yeah. It was actually the first school we ever went to. It was the first school as part of our pilot, because one of our co-founders is a former pupil of Cláiste Isagon across the road, the sister school of Cláiste Óin.
When did you realise that this time there was going to be a problem?
Well, we kind of followed our usual procedures where the workshop was booked in well in advance of the date, and I had checked in with our contact the day before, and it wasn't until half an hour before the workshop yesterday morning at 10:30 that I got an email to say that it wasn't going to be taking place. Our volunteers had already arrived at that stage, and they were informed by a member of staff that the workshop wouldn't be taking place, as they felt, someone from the school had said that they felt that, and I quote, both sides had to be represented. So it was very much a listen-less kind of intervention.
What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, it was quite frustrating. It was also quite baffling, to be honest. I wasn't aware that there were two sides of the argument when it came to bullying. I thought that that was rather straightforward. So I think there was some sort of conflation of the issue of anti-bullying and something more political. Shout Out is strictly apolitical and isn't involved in any of the political movements associated with gay rights or otherwise. So we were very confused and very disappointed by it, primarily disappointed for the students who were supposed to get the workshop, of course.
I'm looking at a statement which was issued to us last night by Cailleadh the Óin. Now, they say that there have been no issues or objections to Shout Out in the past, but they say on this particular occasion, the Board of Management have received written communications from a number of parents outlining their concerns regarding the workshop. And the statement goes on, in this context, it was incumbent on the Board to address all issues and seek the advice available from Catholic management representative bodies available to secondary schools. What's your response?
Well, I mean, every school has its right to its own religious ethos or not, and we completely understand that. What we're confused about, again, is why this was such a last-minute decision. Were protocols not followed in the school that would have allowed them to be made aware of this sooner so that they could cancel with more notice or indeed postpone it? And also, I guess, again, kind of our response to that is that there had never been a problem previously. The workshop hasn't changed. The political climate might have changed. And we're just concerned that that might have had a negative impact on reception of these anti-bullying workshops. And we really don't want to politicise something that is aimed at improving the school experience of all young people. It's definitely something that shouldn't be politicised. It's not something that should be conflated with anything else. And I didn't think that you would have to involve either parents or Catholic management organisations for secondary schools in order to implement an anti-bullying workshop.
The statement also says that the school hopes that you'll be able to make the presentation again in the future. Would you like to go back?
Oh, we'd absolutely love to go back. As I say, we've been there before, and previously we've had a great reception and very good hospitality from the school. We're disappointed with how this has played out yesterday, but we really want to go back, and we're hoping that that can be resolved. If it is an issue of parental consent, as the school has said in its statement last night and concern. We hope that they address those concerns with parents, and we look forward to delivering the workshop in the near future.
And that was Declan Meehan, co-founder of Shout Out. It's 12 minutes to nine. We hear a lot these days about the rise in digital media and the effect this has had on traditional methods of production and distribution in, for example, the music business. However, the traditional book trade may be bucking the trend. Just before Christmas, the head of Waterstones in the UK declared that sales of Kindles in his stores had all but disappeared. And Irish bookshops reported a slight rise in sales in 2014. Following several years of decline. So are printed books fighting back? Our arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley has been finding out.
I have to challenge myself every day. I have to make the books, you know, better than they've ever been. I have to make covers. I have to work with designers to make good covers, which I enjoy doing.
Denise Deegan is well known as a writer of both adult and young adult fiction. She has now decided to reinvent herself as a self-published author under the name Amy Alexander, and thanks to online publishing is selling her e-books all over the world.
They're doing really well in America, and you would think that my market would be more here because they're Irish books written in Ireland, but no. America's a big market for me, which I'm thrilled about.
Ebooks have opened up a whole new market for authors in both the traditional and self-publishing industries. And when they first went on sale, it was feared they could spell the end of the traditional book market altogether. But now it seems a different pattern is emerging. Over Christmas, the head of Waterstones in the UK declared its sales of the Kindle to have all but disappeared. And although Kindle itself doesn't release its sales figures, we do know that bookshops here in Ireland have just had their healthiest Christmas in years. Michael McLaughlin is Managing Director of Penguin Ireland.
The two biggest selling books of last year were the Roy Keane autobiography and the Brian O'Driscoll autobiography, which we published. And they sold significant numbers. Nielsen Bookscan showed that they both sold in or around 50,000 copies, which is quite significantly higher than the best-selling hardback book of last year, which was Eamon Dunphy's book.
Bob Johnson of the Gutter Bookshop in Dublin is chairman of the Irish branch of the Booksellers Association.
And the good thing about it, there was a really nice range of titles. So sports biographies, which we'll talk about, did incredibly well, but good fiction, good kids, good cookery, the Happy Pair cookbook did incredibly well. So there's actually a really nice choice of books. Some Christmases you get like one or two big hitters that kind of suck up everything. This year it was actually kind of quite a nice spread.
We've found that ebook sales have, I suppose, plateaued. It's very hard to get market figures for the whole market, but in the US and in the UK in particular, you know, sales of ebooks have settled around the 20-30% mark, depending on what type of book or genre the ebook is.
Now, these statistics are not, if you'll pardon the book-related pun, totally black and white. Here, the market in e-readers seems more buoyant than it is abroad. Tesco Ireland told me, for example, that its sales of e-readers rose by 21% in the last quarter of 2014, as opposed to the same period in 2013, while Eason said that it too has seen an increase in the sales of the e-reader it stocks, the Kobo. Although Eason's did point out that that doesn't seem to be consistent with the overall trend from countries like the UK and the US, where it says the growth of e-reading and e-book sales are plateauing. What is clear is that far from one taking over the other, it now seems that the electronic and traditional publishing industries may be on the path to peaceful coexistence.
Two things are allowed to exist at the same time. You know, you're allowed to have ebooks and printed books. You know, there's no rule against it. And it seems to be that ebooks now have found their platform and found their level. People are now reading on their, I don't know, their iPads or their tablets or whatever. So people are using and reading on their phones. You know, people are still reading, but in different ways. But overall, the ebook market seems to have settled down.
Ebook sales are increasingly in the fiction area amongst readers who like to read, you know, regularly a book a week or two books a week, and they prefer an e-reader where it's much easier to download and read fast, and you don't have to worry about going into a bookshop. But I think if book sales of e-books remain around the 10 or 20% mark, it does leave a lot of scope for bookshops to continue to thrive. And as publishers, it's really important to us that bookshops continue to survive and to thrive.
Meanwhile, although Denise Deegan thought she'd be selling her Amy Alexander books as e-books only, a customer asked for a paperback version, and she's now distributing both.
Somebody had read Pause to Rewind and had asked me, was I going to do a paperback? And I hadn't really been thinking about that. But then because she had enjoyed the book and wanted to buy one for her daughter and her friend, I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to do it. And also I thought it'd be lovely for my kids to have a copy.
And that was author Denise Deegan ending that report from Sinead Crowley.
A national conference on data protection with a focus on what it calls real-world data protection issues and cybersecurity horror stories gets underway in Dublin Castle today. Max Schrems will be one of the speakers. He's an Austrian lawyer and the founder of Europe versus Facebook. Max, good morning.
Good morning.
What will you be talking about in Dublin today and over the next few days?
I'm mainly going to talk about enforcement of privacy that I think is one of the biggest problems we have right now in Europe, because we're happily talking about privacy and data protection, but the reality is that very little happens in reality. So we do see that there are laws, but they're not properly enforced in most of the European countries. We're usually more engaged in pointing fingers to the U.S. than really doing a lot. And that's usually what I talk the most about, because I think it's the most pressing issue right now.
We were one of the first European countries here to appoint a data protection commissioner. How do we fare compared to the rest of Europe, in your view?
I don't know about the new data protection commissioner. There used to be Billy Hawkes, the old data protection commissioner.
Helen Dixon, yes.
Working on with him for about 3 years, and that was... seriously troublesome, let's put it that way.
Why?
I think generally Ireland is internationally seen as more of like the kind of privacy avoidance place you go to if you don't want to stick to the laws too much, which may change now. We see that the government has put in many more people on the job. We had the trouble in our case that we're not even allowed to see the evidence of cases. We're not even allowed to see, in our own case against Facebook, the submissions of the other party. And for 3 years, we didn't even get a decision. That was practically impossible to enforce anything, which is the reason why we moved out of Ireland with our claim and then went to an Austrian court where we filed a class action recently against Facebook with right now 25,000 people.
You're still involved in that action, of course. I should point out, and you did point out there, the office here has had its budget allocation almost doubled this year. It is hiring more staff, and as I said, we were one of the first countries to appoint a data protection commissioner. You're still involved in that action against Facebook. For many people listening this morning, data protection, you know, it sounds like a very vague issue for them, and yet lots of people were asked in recent months for their PPS numbers to sign up to pay for Irish water. They don't have to do that now, and many parents being asked to submit a lot of information on their children to schools, which is going to be kept for up to 30 years. Should people be worried about stuff like this, or should they just trust the authorities that they've been asked for information? It's for a good reason.
It really depends. There are a lot of different issues where on the table on privacy stuff. There's government surveillance, where I think the biggest trend right now is that we have private companies taking up the data and the government is then taking it after that. For these like really Irish issues about different numbers, I'm really not the expert to talk about. I think overall we do have the problem that a lot of what's happening is happening in the background. So in our case, for example, we're looking mainly at Facebook, which is just one company of many. We could have looked into any other as well. Where we do have a front end where a lot of things just look very reasonable. But if you then look at the back end of what's happening with the data in the background, you see that there's a totally different picture. And that's a part that the general public usually doesn't see.
Max, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you short. And apologies, it was such a short interview. It's almost 9 o'clock. But thank you very much for speaking to us today. Max Schrems, that's founder of Europe versus Facebook, 9 o'clock.